Tonight's reading is from Exodus chapter 33, which can be found on page 92 of the Church Bibles. Exodus 33, beginning at verse 12 and going on to 34, verse 7. Moses said to the Lord, "You have been telling me, 'Lead these people,' but you have not let me know whom you will send with me. You have said, 'I know you by name, and you have found favor with me.' If you are pleased with me, teach me your ways so that I may know you and continue to find favor with you. Remember that this nation is your people." The Lord replied, "My presence will go with you, and I will give you rest." Then Moses said to him, "If your presence does not go with us, do not send us up from here. How will anyone know that you are pleased with me and with your people unless you go with us? What else will distinguish me and your people from all the other people on the face of the earth?" And the Lord said to Moses, "I will do the very thing you have asked, because I am pleased with you and I know you by name." Then Moses said, "Now show me your glory." And the Lord said, "I will cause all my goodness to pass in front of you, and I will proclaim my name, the Lord, in your presence. I will have mercy on whom I will have mercy, and I will have compassion on whom I will have compassion." But, he said, "You cannot see my face, for no one may see me and live." Then the Lord said, "There is a place near me where you may stand on a rock. When my glory passes by, I will put you in a cleft in the rock and cover you with my hand until I have passed by. Then I will remove my hand and you will see my back, but my face must not be seen." The Lord said to Moses, "Chisel out 2 stone tablets like the first ones, and I will write on them the words that were on the first tablets which you broke. Be ready in the morning, and then come up on Mount Sinai. Present yourself to me there on top of the mountain. No one is to come with you or be seen anywhere on the mountain. Not even the flocks and herds may graze in front of the mountain." So Moses chiseled out 2 stone tablets like the first ones and went up Mount Sinai early in the morning, as the Lord had commanded him. And he carried the 2 stone tablets in his hands. Then the Lord came down in the cloud and stood there with him and proclaimed his name, the Lord. And he passed in front of Moses, proclaiming, the Lord, the compassionate and gracious God, slow to anger, abounding in love and faithfulness, maintaining love to thousands and forgiving wickedness, rebellion and sin. Yet he does not leave the guilty unpunished. He punishes the children and their children for the sin of the fathers to the 3rd and 4th generation."
Emma, thank you. Perhaps you keep a finger in that passage and turn on to Romans 5, which is a passage we've been studying, page 1132, page 1132, for the last of our series in Romans 5. And today we're looking at the end of verse 2, and then a few verses following. Romans 5, page 1132. Now, if you were to pin up the thing that you were most proud of in your life, what would it be, I wonder? I used to work in a building where the regiment I served had a display cabinet in the entrance hall with all the old battle honours and trophies on display. Our berries had various battle triumphs listed on them on a cap badge, slightly triumphalistic, I think, probably, but it was good for morale. If you were to have, say, a display cabinet like that, or a cap badge, what would you put in it? Some people pin up the thing they exult in most on their walls. I wonder if you have something like that, you know, a photo of yourself with your mum and dad, and on the day that you qualified or graduated, there you are in your black dressing gown with what looks like a rabbit on your head, looking like somebody out of the Ku Klux Klan, but you're proud as punch of it. Some people pin up another person, someone else they take huge pride in. Noel Gallagher, Eric the King, the Spice Girls. Now, tonight we're looking at a word which at heart means to boast or to exult or delight or rejoice triumphantly. And it's a big word in Paul's letter to the Romans. To get it in perspective, it's worth having a quick look at it in chapter 2, verse 17. He talks about the Jews boasting or bragging or rejoicing in the law and their relationship to God. It's there in 2:23. Where he talks about, again, boasting or bragging or rejoicing or exulting in the law. It's there in 4:2. Where he talks about Abraham, if he was made right with God by works, then he did have something to boast about. All those are inappropriate or wrong forms of boasting or exulting. But tonight, in our passage, there are three forms of right or correct rejoicing and exulting that Paul is introducing us to as a result of God's work for us on the cross. So we're going to spend our time looking at those, and one or two in more detail than the other. First, we rejoice or exult or glory in the certain restoration to God's glory. And that's at the end of our verse, verse 2. We rejoice in the hope of the glory of God. And just to get our terms clear, it's important to realize that that word hope is one which you and I usually use in a different way to the way that Paul is using it here. You see, we use the word hope to express a desire for an uncertain future outcome. I hope I pass my exams. I hope she says yes. I hope it doesn't rain. I hope Manchester United win. You see, you may hope, you can hope all you like, but your hope expressed in those terms is, well, little more than a wish. You have little control over the answer, which remains uncertain and insecure. But Paul and the rest of the New Testament writers use this word hope to express a confident, certain expectation of what will definitely happen in the future. It's not the prospect of what might happen. It is the certainty of what will happen. One of the things one tends to do when one has children is to watch the same film over and over again. I could go on Mastermind and take as my chosen specialist subject the Walt Disney film Bambi. It is a dreadful film. All the animals have middle-class Judeo-Christian morals. None of them eat each other or savage each other, and they all have mid-Atlantic accents. It has some scary moments. Bambi's mother gets the good news from some hunters. Hunting dogs attempt to savage Bambi's girlfriend. But you see, when you know the end from the beginning, well, you can watch any film like that with confidence and with certainty. With a New Testament type of hope, the end is sure. Bambi's mother may come a cropper, but he escapes the huntsman, is crowned king of the forest, and ends up marrying his fawnhood sweetheart. Now, if you've been with us over the last few weeks, you'll have seen Paul showing us a snapshot, if you like, of the end. By taking us back to the cross, he has effectively pressed the fast forward button and shown us what lies ahead. Without Jesus, we face certain condemnation, the righteous, fully deserved wrath of a holy God on his final day of judgment, certainly. But in the light of Jesus and his death on the cross, the factual, verifiable event of past history, we have been justified, he says in verse 1. And we now, verse 2, live in a state of favour with God. But now, he says, we can rejoice, exult, delight, boast in the certain, confident, definite expectation of the glory of God. So I hope you understand that word hope. It's as if we've been shown a snapshot of the future by seeing the verdict of God borne by Jesus, the wrath of God borne by Jesus, so that we can know that the future is sure for us. But that brings us on to the next technical word in our little verse. See, what is it that Paul is so confident about? What is this glory of God about which he is so sure? Well, at heart, it has to do with heaven. So when Paul says we rejoice in the hope of glory, he's saying, now that our sins have been fully accounted for back then, once and for all, by Jesus on the cross, we can be 100% certain of heaven. So much so that we can exult in it and boast about it and rejoice in its absolute certainty and definite existence. Now, there are many ways in which heaven can be described. We recently talked about the longing we all have for a future free from sin when we were looking at Matthew's Gospel together. Don't you long for that freedom? The freedom from the presence and effect of sin? Paul does. He goes so far in chapter 8 to talk about the whole creation groaning, as in the pains of childbirth, which are considerable, as it longs for the freedom from the frustrations of sin. And we only have to pick up a newspaper today and glance at it for a few seconds to see how much our whole society is longing to be free from the frustrations of sin. That's what the whole moral crusade is about at the moment. But heaven isn't only described in terms of moral purity. It is described as a huge party with Christ at its centre. Or for those who don't like parties, it's described as a glorious rural idyll with peace reigning. For those who don't like the country, it's talked about in terms of a perfect city. Don't you long for it? See, as you experience your own feeble morals, or the weakness and frailty of your body, or the pain of bereavement, or the constant ongoing struggle of daily battle with sin, don't you long to be in God's perfect eternity forever? Now, do you see what Paul is saying in our verse? As a result of that past event on the cross, when Jesus was presented by God as a sacrifice of atonement, as we've seen, to take his anger at our sin, as a result of that, well, we have a snapshot of the future. God's wrath has been dealt with forever. And we, if we trust in Jesus, can rejoice confidently in certain expectation of eternity with God and sin removed. But if we were to look at heaven in just terms like that, I want to suggest that we would miss a large part of what Paul is driving at and a key emphasis of what Paul's been going on about in his whole letter to the Romans. So I want you to look again at our verse. We rejoice in the hope of the glory of God. Do you see, it's not just me and my glorification in heaven that Paul is rejoicing in. It is God and his glory and his glorious achievement. Now that's why I asked Emma to read that passage from Exodus at the start of our talk. You see, when God shows his back to Moses and shows him something of his presence, he tells Moses that he's going to see God's glory. What does Moses see? Well, God sort of shows Moses his presence. But what is God's presence? Well, if you're there, just have a look at chapter 33, verse 6. Don't bother if you're not. I'll read it to you. Chapter 34, verse 6, I think. Is that what I'm after? God passed in front of Moses, proclaiming, the Lord, the compassionate and gracious God, slow to anger, abounding in love and faithfulness, maintaining love to thousands and forgiving wickedness, rebellion and sin. Yet he does not leave the guilty unpunished. He punishes the children and their children for the sin of their fathers to the third and fourth generation. See, above all else, what Paul is talking about in Romans chapter 5 is the glory of God, the reality of his presence. And his presence is expressed in terms of his character. full of grace, slow to anger, faithful, full of love, forgiveness, ready and willing to forgive, and ready and willing to justly and righteously deal with sin forever. Do you begin to see that, yes, this idea of God's glory has to do with a glorious future of a glorious new heaven and earth where we will be. It is a glorious place. But even more it has in Romans to do with the King and the central character of this new heaven and the new earth, who establishes it and reigns in it, whose plans and purposes to call a people to himself and deal justly with their sin and enable them to live with him forever, experiencing his compassion and love and faithfulness and forgiveness and purity and justice and holiness, is accomplished. Now, Paul has already described us as having fallen short of God's glory, having been cut out of his presence, destined with certainty to face his moral anger and wrath. But now do you see what he's saying? As a result of Jesus' action on our behalf, taking his wrath at our sin on himself, we rejoice in the certainty, the reality, of enjoying this presence of the compassionate Father forever, and of seeing his compassion and justice and love established securely forever. Nothing can stop it, says Paul. We've seen the snapshot of the end as we've gone back to the cross. Our rebellion has been dealt with, and the verdict has been announced. And so we can rejoice in certain expectation, if we trust in Jesus, of seeing the vindication of God in all his justice and compassion and mercy. Now I wonder when you last stopped to think about what the future holds for you. I don't mean what next week or next month or next year holds. I don't even mean who you might marry or what your career might be or might not be. I mean, when did you last stop to think about your death and what lies beyond and eternity? Some people are terrified by it, so they don't think about it too much. It's too frightening. Others are too busy. There's just too much to worry about in the present, things to enjoy now, frantic activity to engage in, pressing appointments, engagements, and so on. But, says Paul to us Christians, the future is so secure that we can boast in it, exult in it, delight in it, rejoice in it. We can pin it up, if you like, in our display cabinet with absolute, definite confidence. No need to say prayers for us when we die. No need to ask special saints to intercede for us when we die. No need for any doubt about where we might go, or any fear of what might lay beyond in the valley of the shadow of death when we die. Because you see, as we go back to the cross, we see a snapshot of the future. And we see God's righteous anger at our sin being poured out on his Son, so that our future in his kingdom is guaranteed forever. That's our first cause of boasting or exulting. We rejoice in the certain restoration to his glory. But someone might say to Paul, just hold on a minute, Paul, I mean, I don't have this glory now. Just look around at my life. It is beset with difficulties and trials. What of the present? Surely Paul isn't saying we should just forget all sense of the present and skip about in life with one of those happy, jolly grins on our face, pretending all the horrific realities of today just don't happen. Is Paul living in cloud cuckoo land? Well, as usual, Paul is one step ahead of us. And in verse 3, he says, far from being bemused at our sufferings, we are to rejoice in them. Not only do we rejoice in our hope of the future, But we also rejoice in our sufferings, because we know that suffering produces perseverance. Perseverance, character. And character, hope. And it's important to realize that the sufferings he's talking about here are not just the trials of persecution for believing Christians. They are certainly included. But Paul goes on in chapter 6 to 8 to mention the kind of trials and sufferings that Christians face today as we live in a fallen world. The battle or struggle with ongoing sin and temptation. The struggle with keeping going as a Christian through sickness, weak and frail bodies, death. The sheer hardship of keeping going as a Christian in a world that is going the opposite way to us. Now, as we read verses 3 and 4, Paul's point is that these sufferings and the battles of ordinary everyday life as a Christian cause him to exult. It's not that they don't cause him to groan and weep and cry out in pain. We've already seen that they do. But they also cause him to rejoice, because the very fact that he's engaged in them show that the faith and love that God has poured into his heart is genuine. And so he can look beyond them and be confident of a glorious future. Do you see the logic? It hangs on the word character in verse 3. And that word means provedness or testedness. And his point is, the fact that I'm experiencing hardship is causing me to persevere through it and keep going. And the fact that I'm persevering through it and keeping going is showing that God really is at work within me. So I have a right to be confident about my future. Let's read those verses again. Not only so, we also rejoice in our sufferings, because we know that suffering produces perseverance. Perseverance, testedness or provedness. And this character, hope. See, if we just sailed through life from one triumph to another, experiencing an unending bliss and permanent blessing, how would we ever know that God had really begun a work in us? Let me give you an illustration, a silly illustration of Paul's logic, of Paul's point. My father-in-law is a very keen fisherman, and I mean he is very, very keen. He recently purchased a magnificent floating jacket, and the purpose of the thing was to provide ballast if ever he were to fall into the river when he was wading. Now let me just tell you, as he pointed out to me in great detail, that it is not just any old floating jacket. Some fishermen would be happy to stick a lump of balsa wood on their back and hope for the best. But this jacket is the latest. It has a device in it which, when it gets wet, sets off a tiny detonator, which then triggers a gas canister, which fills the airbags and makes the jacket expand and float. It's absolutely tremendous. 3 weeks ago, he was out fishing, and to my immense sadness and lasting distress, I was not there. He slipped when walking in a tiny shallow puddle beside the river. There was no danger, no hint of even having to wade or let alone swim. But it was enough. There apparently ensued a 35-second desperate scramble that looked like Houdini on amphetamines. And then, before he was able to get the jacket off, there was a sharp crack followed by a ferocious hissing. Now, I and all other fishermen, apart from rolling around on the floor in hysterics, are immensely reassured, because it has been tested. It works. There is a reality about the claims that the manufacturers make. Now, it's a silly little illustration, but it makes the point, I hope. You see, we don't experience the full reality of God's glory now. We do, as Christians, face a great many battles and many sufferings. If you're here as a non-Christian tonight, let me just assure you from personal experience that it is not easy for us swimming against the tide. Those of us who have become Christians have abandoned the crutches of just being like everybody else and are struggling to live as believers today through many hardships. But those hardships shouldn't make us doubt. quite the opposite. Our faith is fueled rather than dampened by our present lack of glory, because it shows that there is life in us as we persevere and are put to the test and stand firm. And just to make sure that we got the point, Paul then takes us back to the cross again in verses 5 to 10. We haven't got time to spend a long time in there tonight, but I want you to be clear that verse 5 is not saying that I can be sure of the future because I occasionally feel all lovey-dovey about Jesus or have gooey feelings about him. I may well do those things. But verse 5, look at it closely, is not talking about me and my love for God. See what the Holy Spirit has poured out into our hearts? It's his love, which is explained in verse 8 as being the fact that while we were still sinners, Christ died for me. So those verses are pointing us again back to the cross and reminding us that the faith that is proved to be genuine as we endure through sufferings is a faith in the objective reality of the cross of Christ, which guarantees our future. She's giving us a snapshot again of the past, showing us that the future is secure. Now, once again, let me ask you, what kind of Christian are you? How do you view your present situation? All of us here will be going through one kind of trial or another. It's not just the super spiritual, mega keen, spiritual elite who face hardship. It's not just the spiritual weeds who feel downtrodden. From a personal point of view, I find living the Christian life a constant and real battle. It's a battle with sin, pride and arrogance. You may wonder what about, but it is. It's a daily battle with my own frailty. I wish I could achieve what some of these other apparent super saints around me seem to manage. I wish I could be up first thing in the morning saying my prayers every day before dawn. It's a tough battle to be out and doing that. It's a battle with preparation to keep at it so I can teach others. It's a battle with sickness sometimes, with sadness occasionally, to keep going when it comes along. And I have to say, the more people I talk to, the more people I realise are just like that. However sussed they appear to have the Christian life, every single person who is a genuine Christian here will be going through some sort of battle or another. How do we view them, these battles? See, Paul's not saying we should go out and look for them and then shout, yippee, when they come. Look how much I'm suffering. What he's saying is that when they come, we should see them rightly. They shouldn't cause us to doubt. Quite the opposite. The fact that we go on trusting God through these trials when they come is proof that God really is at work in us. He really has poured out an understanding of his love into our lives. Even when we stumble and fall and have to pick ourselves up for a 100th time. If you weren't a Christian, let me tell you, you wouldn't bother. You wouldn't be facing the battle. So as they come, we should rejoice in the proof that we really do have a future certainty of glory, because God really is doing a work within us. So first, our understanding of what God has done through Jesus on the cross means that we rejoice in our certain future in heaven with God forever, who we will see as glorious, having achieved his plan for the universe. Secondly, our understanding of what God has done through Jesus on the cross means that we rejoice even in our present sufferings. And finally, in conclusion, the third rejoice, which we will just touch on very briefly, is there in verse 11. Not only is this so, but we also exult, boast, delight in God through our Lord Jesus Christ, through whom we have now received reconciliation. What is it that you pin up on your wall? If you had a display cabinet, what would go in it? Paul's already pointed out to us a wrong sort of boasting. We looked at it right at the beginning. It's the boasting of the religious person who has in their display cabinet all the things that I have done for God. I've lived a good life. I've done the Cornhill training course. I'm from a Christian family. I was baptized by total immersion as an adult. I went forward at a Billy Graham crusade. I served at camp. I work in After Eights. I lead RML, or City Focus. And Paul has told us that to have those sort of things in our display cabinet is absolutely useless, because they don't bring reconciliation with God. They can't deal with our sin and our rebellion against God. They won't prevent us facing his certain wrath on his final day of judgment. But there is a right sort of boasting, and that is the boasting that is described in verse 11. It is a boasting in God. See, I want to suggest that even as supposedly well-taught Christians, you and I all too often conduct the wrong sort of boasting. We rejoice and exult and delight in what God has done for me in the present, so that I am the subject of my boasting, and now is the time scale of my boasting. So that when somebody asks me what is so brilliant about being a Christian, well, all I can talk of is going to my display cabinet and showing them my present experience, my sense of purpose now, my self-esteem now, my sense of peace now, my blessing now. Now, don't get me wrong, of course there is real Christian experience to rejoice about and delight in. But you see, as far as Paul is concerned, his delight, his pride, the thing he pins up and sticks in his display cabinet, isn't so much to do with him as to do with God. The hope of the glory of God. The knowledge that certainly one day we will see God vindicated, compassionate, forgiving justly, punishing sin, and establishing his certain rule forever. He's not rejoicing so much that Paul will be skipping about in heaven, although that is there. He's rejoicing in the final glory of God. Then he's rejoicing in his present suffering, which proves that he will be there, because God has begun a work in him. And finally, he is rejoicing in God himself, as he looks back to the cross of what Jesus Christ has done, that we now have reconciliation and God has achieved that for us.